Previously on A Democratic Socialist Almanac.
Within the zones that were freed from the regime, Syrians established a form of direct democracy that we should hold on par with the Paris Commune. As early as March 2011, protest leaders began organizing local coordinating committees, Soviets, if you will, where all were equal. It became the government in freed areas of Syria. These committees were inspired by the writings of Omar Aziz. And in the city they began in, Douma, activists set up women's centers to advocate against gender discrimination. In fact, everything the progressive movement in the United States has been working towards, Syrians also work towards while simultaneously fighting for their lives against a vicious authoritarian regime. Here's the podcast where we talk about U.S. involvement and ISIS in the Syrian revolution. We've had two episodes so far where we talked about the Syrian revolution, where we centered Syrian voices in explaining how the revolution came about. But now we have to talk about Western involvement. It seems to be a preoccupation with the U.S. left. Up until 2011, Bashar al-Assad was considered a potential partner in the region by the American administration. His father Hafez had helped the U.S. to fight Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. And as is well known, Bill Clinton used to have terrorism suspects sent to Syria to be tortured. Sam Dogger remarks on this permissive attitude, quote, "After the Second World War, successive U.S. administrations viewed the newly independent states of the Levant and Arabian Peninsula, including Syria, mainly through the prism of the Cold War struggles with the Soviet Union. Washington's priorities were to secure oil supplies and find a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Few of the Middle East's rising tyrants knew how to exploit this broader geostrategic game better than Hafez al-Assad. By the mid-1970s, Hafez, who was busy enshrining a cultist dictatorship in Syria, received military aid and support from the Soviet Union at the same time that he was getting recognition and financial aid from the U.S. and its rich Gulf Arab allies. There was an unspoken but well-understood quid pro quo with Washington. Hafez was free to do everything he needed to do to maintain his iron grip at home as long as he never waged war against Israel after 1973. Jimmy Carter later called Hafez a, quote, strong and moderate leader, unquote. Throughout the U.S.'s occupation of Iraq, Bashar al-Assad had allowed foreign Islamist extremists to enter Iraq through Syria. There they joined with al-Qaeda agents who were being funded by Iran and managed by Qasem Soleimani. When Obama was elected into the office of the President of the United States, Bashar correctly saw an opportunity. Quote, for him, Bashar al-Assad, the real prize was not France or Europe, but the United States, where a more momentous change of guard and opportunity occurred. A young senator named Barack Obama had become America's first black president. Obama regarded Iraq's invasion as a disastrous mistake and wanted to get out as quickly as possible. He wanted to make a clear break with Bush's policies, to change America's image as the world's sheriff and a cowboy who shoots first and asks questions later. Obama had priorities beyond Middle East regime change. The way Bashar and his allies saw it, Obama seemed like a realist, someone who was not going to hector them about reform and human rights, but potentially accept that each country had its particular circumstances and situations. Obama wasted no time in trying to secure Bashar's and, by extension, Iran's cooperation in Iraq. He dispatched John Kerry to Damascus in February 2009. The gentlemanly Kerry, a longtime senator and chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, already had one thing in common with Bashar, a towering presence. They were both really tall, I guess. And trying to develop a personal rapport with Bashar, Kerry came with his wife, Teresa Hines, unquote. By all accounts, John Kerry was completely won over by the Assad charm offensive. Quote, toward the end of his stay in Damascus, Kerry met Michel Duclos, the French ambassador. Kerry, a fluent French speaker, said he believed he finally had a deal with Bashar on stopping the infiltration of foreign fighters to Iraq and sharing the identities of al-Qaeda operatives. Quote, "This is a man we can do business with," unquote, an upbeat Kerry told Duclos. "Kerry was totally beguiled by Asma and Bashar," observed Duclos. Unquote. Sam Dogger's excellent history of the Syrian Revolution, Assad or We Burn the Country, focuses on the decision-making process within the Assad regime, which Dogger had special access to through interviews with Manaf Talas, close friend with Bashar al-Assad from childhood, and the son of Mustafa Talas, who was Hafez al-Assad's old comrade from their days as cadets in the military academy. Dogger tells us how the French government was trying to prepare Manaf to take power in order to keep the regime in place, in case Bashar was rejected by the Syrian ruling class the way Mubarak had been in Egypt, and how despite Manaf's arguing for reforms as a response to the protest movement, Bashar and company decided to resurrect the Hama Manual. During the course of the spring and summer of 2011, it became clear that the Assad regime intended to use intense violence against protesters, and this created a feedback loop whereby harsher methods inspired bigger protests, inspiring harsher methods. The Obama administration, not wishing to lose their partner in Syria, asked Assad to cede power to someone else in his ruling clique. Because of Sam Dogger's work in interviewing Manaf Talas, we know that the French intelligence agencies were grooming him for that role. If Assad had obeyed Obama's plea, which was clearly not going to be backed up with serious action, the Ba'ath Party would have remained in control of Syria, much as the ruling clique in Egypt remained in power after Mubarak stepped down. One of Obama's proudest achievements was the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. The bulk of U.S. forces, some 140,000 troops, left Iraq in December of 2011. In the next few years, Obama tried desperately to avoid America re-engaging militarily in the region, despite the emergence of ISIS over this period. In 2012, ISIS murdered the journalist Jim Foley. In 2013, they killed the journalist Stephen Sotloff. They did these targeted killings in a very sensational manner. They videotaped them, and they showed the knife, and then they showed the head afterwards. And they really wanted people to be terrified and to hate them because they wanted to attract military intervention from the United States. In 2014, as ISIS militants gained territory within striking distance of an American diplomatic mission in Erbil, Obama finally authorized limited airstrikes against ISIS targets. By that point, American inaction regarding the group was read by regular Iraqis as America supporting ISIS. Richard Stengel, former editor of Time magazine and Undersecretary of State for the Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs under Obama, cites polling of Iraqis in 2014. Quote, "A majority of Iraqis, Sunni and Shia, actually thought that the U.S. had created ISIS. I asked one intelligence officer why this was. He smiled and replied that most Iraqis say, quote, 'We have seen what you are capable of when you invaded us, and the fact that you are not doing it to them must mean that you are on their side,' unquote." In reality, starting in 2012, America had two different programs to arm Syrian rebels in order to fight ISIS. Syrian rebels, with the exception of a few dozen people, rejected this aid because it came only if the recipients promised not to fight the Assad regime, which Obama hoped to normalize relations with. Most of this military aid went to the Kurds, who have been fighting alongside U.S. forces against ISIS. The main way that the U.S. intervened during the course of the revolution was the CIA setting itself up as a middleman between rebel groups and Saudi Arabia to ensure that the rebels never received anti-air weapons that could stop the regime's vicious targeting of civilian areas, though they did receive some anti-tank weapons. In an interview with Rania Abuzaid, Hamza Shamali, the leader of the Hazem group that received support through the CIA under the program named Sycamore Timber, complained that though their network provided the U.S. with good information about the whereabouts and activities of ISIS leadership, that the U.S. did nothing with the intelligence, a state of affairs that persisted until 2014. Hamza Shamali comments, quote, "On September 23, 2014, after years of watching the ascendancy of Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, America's military directly intervened in Syria's war, striking Islamic State positions and lobbing missiles toward eight locations in Idlib and Aleppo held by the Nusra-affiliated Khorasan group. The United States had launched its war on ISIS in Iraq on August 8th and expanded it into Syria the following month. Many Syrians wondered why the United States waited until Islamic State was at the height of its power to attack it. In early November, Nusra fighters easily routed Hazem from its main stronghold in Idlib province, seizing Hazem's cache of U.S.-supplied weapons, including TOW anti-tank missiles. The base fell without a fight, and the hundreds of Hazem fighters either escaped to Aleppo, defected to Nusra, or were detained." Unquote. If anyone imagines that this financial aid affected the political loyalties of the Syrian resistance, consider that in 2014, when the U.S. began conducting airstrikes against targets in Syria, this very group that received funding from the U.S. loudly criticized the attacks, while the Assad regime cheered for them. From an article in Syria Direct News, quote, "Various rebel groups condemned U.S.-led airstrikes on the Islamic State and other extremist targets within Syria on Tuesday and Wednesday. Harakat Hazem, a moderate-leaning rebel coalition that has received aid from the United States, called the strikes an act of aggression towards national sovereignty in a press release widely circulated Tuesday on social media websites. Meanwhile, the pro-government news network Damascus Now hailed the strikes on Wednesday as a historic moment in which, quote, happiness was etched on the faces of the majority of Syrians because they found international support towards eradicating a cancer which has been rooted in the diseased Syrian body, referring to the rebels." Unquote. Obama's hands-off attitude about Syria represented well the prevailing mood of the country. The Iraq War was such a debacle that few on the right or left could afford to recommend more military engagement. This is surely the only way to explain how a nation that had rallied to the global war on terror could watch its journalists getting slaughtered by a rising authoritarian Islamist extremist organization and not clamor for national defense. But in 2013, an event occurred that would test the nation's pacifist resolve. And then all the left-wing groups that were supporters of Bashar al-Assad would once again command the national spotlight. Just this past April, this is in 2020, a group of inspectors from the United Nations Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons found conclusively that Bashar al-Assad was responsible for the chemical attack in Ghouta in 2013. They were the first body of inspectors to be granted the authority to assign culpability for this terrible crime. The report is not published yet, but its main findings have been reported to the press. On the 21st of August, 2013, the Assad regime used sarin gas to murder nearly 1,400 people in the Ghouta, which again was the neighborhood that led the rebellion against the French in 1925 and again in 1945. Because certain bad actors have made the argument that Syrian rebels perpetrated this terrible crime, it's worth laying out the evidence we have, even without the UN's new report in detail. Bellingcat is an international group doing investigative journalism using the latest technology. From publicly available news sources, they were able to identify military units who were actively engaged in operations near the Ghouta, within range to deliver the volcano rockets that conveyed the sarin gas and immediately benefiting militarily from the strikes. Specifically, Bellingcat was able to confirm eyewitness accounts of a group of 15 armored vehicles that took advantage of the immediate aftermath of the chemical attacks in Ghouta to seize the nearby Jobar neighborhood. Because every detail of the attack has been subject to misinformation, we must point out that the nature of the agent used was verified from 12 samples taken a week after the attack, that the remnants of the volcano missile found at the center of the attack confirm its use as a conveyance. Further, the Syrian government admitted to owning a stockpile of hexamine and isopropyl alcohol, both items that have to be stored separately until the last moment. After mixing of these components, the resulting sarin compound cannot be stored beyond a very short term before it eats through any container. Therefore, the facilities required to refine sarin gas are beyond the means of rebels under siege who lack powdered milk and tea. The stories one has to tell to imagine rebels using such an advanced weapon border on science fiction. Imagining secret labs in Iraq or smuggling through Turkey, not to mention that the support of the Syrian people has always been essential to the success of the revolution. This is also the article where Bellingcat addresses Ted Postol's attacks on their work, attacks which cite conspiracy theorists who regularly appear on Alex Jones. Countering the ongoing information war against the Syrian people requires vigilance, and Bellingcat delivers. I'm linking articles in the transcripts, and here's one from January of this year further debunking conspiracy theories around the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons. Bellingcat has been closely following the regime's use of chemical weapons on the Syrian people, including four such occasions since 2018. People who said that the Syrians gassed themselves were following a long tradition of misinformation stretching back to Guernica, where the Nazis murdered hundreds of people intentionally, bombing civilian areas, and then Franco said the people of the town had burned their own buildings down to make it look like they had been bombed. The U.S. left responded as though America was about to invade Syria. Their unfortunate response was to spread Russian disinformation about the chemical attacks, slander the Syrian Democratic Resistance, and protest against the U.S. doing anything at all about the slaughter of the Syrian people, even as those Syrian people clamored for a no-fly zone. Since then, there have been verifiably 500,000 Syrian civilians murdered by Assad, and around 7 million more forced to flee. The Lebanese political scientist and professor of Middle East Studies at the American University of Paris, Ziad Majid, blessed us in 2014 with his very deep book, Syrie, la révolution orpheline. Syria, the orphaned revolution. If you can read French, you should get a copy. It's short. It's good. The translation here is my own, not the official translation. Majid comments. Starting in March of 2011, the Syrian revolution was the object of multiple vilification campaigns coming from various quarters in the Arab and Western world. These included nationalists right and left. These attacks contributed to the eclipse of the Syrian people and their aspirations. This was exactly what the Assad regime wanted. One must distinguish among these enemies of the revolution. On the one hand, were those who pretended to be neutral and would not condemn the crimes of the regime. On the other hand were those, no doubt considering themselves better informed, who theorized gravely about a vast colonialist conspiracy against the quote-unquote resistance regime. Still others felt the need to disfigure the meaning of the revolution, to dehumanize Syrians and transform them into quote-unquote naturally violent creatures with whom one could not empathize. With racism and xenophobia, they refused to recognize Syrians' rights to live in liberty and dignity. Unquote. Sadly, many of the left commentators who fueled this frenzy of lies and anti-solidarity are still with us, and they are not to be trusted, Here are some of the highlights from the left press during that shameful period. In September of 2013, Slavoj Žižek wrote for The Guardian that the Syrian revolution was a pseudo-struggle that lacked emancipatory potential. In that same year, Tariq Ali in the London Review of Books repeated Russian and Iranian talking points about the attack somehow not serving Assad, but at the same time insinuates that maybe the U.S. did the attack because the U.S. wants an excuse for war. But Ali's piece was just a prelude to what Seymour Hersh published in the London Review of Books in December of 2013. Hersh became famous for his work uncovering the My Lai massacre in 1969, but he disgraced his legacy in this article when, citing unnamed sources, he claimed that Syrian rebels had manufactured sarin gas and then used it on themselves. The World Socialist website, this socialist group who said that Ta-Nehisi Coates was a bourgeois reactionary. In 2013, they wrote a lack of thinking piece claiming that the whole opposition movement to Assad was a Western-backed insurgency and that the chemical weapons attack was being used as an excuse to extend U.S. empire over the energy resources of Syria. It should be no surprise to anyone familiar with them that the Party for Socialist Liberation was declaiming supposed U.S. attempts at regime change in Syria going all the way back to 2005, at least. I guess that's when they started publishing online. Throughout 2012 and in the months before the sarin attacks in Ghouta, the PSL was organizing protests against U.S. intervention in Syria. On the day after the attacks, they simply published a link to Russian state TV, where Brian Becker was calling this atrocity a staged provocation. The Answer Coalition is the leading anti-war coalition in the U.S., formed just after September 11, 2001. Answer is really just a front group for the Party for Socialist Liberation. So far, I can't see that their blatant support for the genocidal Bashar al-Assad and parroting of Russian propaganda has lost them an audience on the left, as it should. In the early 70s, Willis Carto made a name for himself, popularizing Holocaust denial. Max Blumenthal is a journalist who has published in the New York Times and The Nation, and he is the Willis Carto of Syrian genocide denial. As late as 2019, he and Rania Khalik visited Assad-controlled territory in an attempt to rehabilitate the genocidal regime. Mainly, Blumenthal publishes these days on a Russian propaganda site called The Gray Zone, which is named after a concept in Russian military theory that involves spreading disinformation to tear down democratic institutions. Katie Halper stands Max Blumenthal, and in the transcripts, I'm adding a tweet by Katie Halpern from November of 2019, where she says, "Max Blumenthal talks about Syria, the White Helmets, and James Le Messurier in this interview with me and Matt Taibbi on our Useful Idiots podcast. People can accuse Max, me, or Matt of bias, but not fact-checkers at the Rolling Stone." These people have told endless lies about the Syrian opposition and named their online news site Gray Zone after a Russian information operation. It's like they're making fun of us for even taking them seriously as a news site. They cannot be trusted to tell the truth, and they should have no place in our media. Code Pink led protests against U.S. intervention in Indiana in 2013 with messaging that makes one think they just reused the same signs they had used to protest the Iraq War, as though Iraq were Syria, as if they were not distinct places in time and in space. I guess if you're a hammer, every problem is a nail. I could continue on this vein for a very long time, but I think that's more than enough bile for one podcast. Suffice it to say that these quote-unquote anti-war activists preferred that Assad be allowed to massacre his people, and they won. the inability of the U.S. left to see through Russian propaganda, which in the case of Syria so neatly dovetailed with all of the priors that American leftists have about U.S. intervention, that gullibility towards Russian propaganda is still very prominent on the left, because as a movement, we never came to terms with how wrong we were about Syria. These left writers have to be discussed in the context of U.S. action against Syria because they share responsibility for Obama's inaction. What's truly breathtaking in all of this is that the U.S. left and the Trumpist right wing seem to agree that Obama literally funded and created ISIS. The truth is that Obama's slow, late, and half-hearted fight against ISIS allowed them to come about, but that lame response was exactly what the far left wanted of Obama. It didn't stop them from labeling him an imperialist. But I don't blame Obama for ISIS. It's closer to the truth to say that ISIS was created by the Assad regime. First of all, Bashar al-Assad's regime had allowed foreign Islamist extremist fighters to enter Iraq through the U.S. occupation, feeding an insurgency there that was funded by Iran. Then, as the Assad regime was murdering and jailing peaceful protesters en masse in 2011, it released nearly 1,300 Islamists from Saydnaya prison, one of the Syrian regime's very worst prisons. This was a clear repetition of its tactics in Hama in 1982, when it first murdered peaceful leadership and then used the militant tendency in the Muslim Brotherhood that remained as an excuse to slaughter civilians. Over the course of the revolution, the regime regularly ceded territory to ISIS, whilst using ISIS as an excuse to bomb civilian areas. America, throughout the last decade of fighting, has imagined it can fight ISIS and keep the regime, but this is patently false. In 2015, as Russia began bombing centers of civilian population in Syria, NATO withdrew its Patriot missiles from Turkey. That summer, Assad bragged publicly that the U.S. voiced public opposition to him, but supported him in private. Assad's army was so diminished by 2016 that the army that was fielded to take back Aleppo consisted in 80% foreign fighters, mainly from Iran. Yassin Kassab and al-Shami note, quote, "On the 17th of July 2016, following weeks of Russian bombing and ground attacks by Iran-backed militia, the regime captured the Castello Road and thereby placed the liberated city under siege. Russian and Assadist planes upped the war in hospitals, hitting 6 medical facilities in 24 hours on the 23rd and the 24th of July. The U.S. administration had nothing to say about this. On the contrary, President Obama approved a proposal to coordinate American airstrikes with Russia against Jabhat al-Nusra. America watched or actively collaborated as Russia, Iran, and Assad drove Aleppo into the abyss." Unquote. In 2017, the new president, Donald Trump, was forced by his wife, Melania, to watch videos of victims of a terrible gas attack by the regime in Khan Shaykhun. Always impulsive and moved by the images, Trump ordered that the airbase be attacked from which the bombs had originated. The airbase was given 24 hours warning, so it was evacuated beforehand. No one was killed, and the base was operational within another 24 hours. In October of 2019, the U.S. withdrew troops from northeast Syria that had been fighting ISIS with Kurdish forces there. Turkish forces promptly invaded, overwhelming formerly Rojavan territory and facilitating the release of ISIS fighters from a jail that Kurdish forces had to abandon to mount a defense against the Turks. Throughout the past decade, the U.S. has pursued a policy in Syria that tried to de-escalate the conflict with Russia, maintain the stability of the Assad regime, and fight ISIS without fighting the root causes of ISIS. And the anti-war movement in the U.S. has declared all of this a great victory. It's not an honorable record, But at no point did the U.S. instigate protests or give arms or soldiers to a coup attempt. As of this writing, the U.S. and Europe have declined to support their NATO ally, Turkey, in fighting back against Russian and Syrian forces who have been tightening a noose around free Syrians in Idlib. That is the sum of the U.S. involvement in Syria. The left hysteria about the Syrian resistance being Islamist extremists was a sharp 180-degree turn from their rhetoric regarding terrorism during the course of the Iraq War. The line that came down to all of us from Susan Sontag and Noam Chomsky was that September 11th attacks were our comeuppance for the history of U.S. imperialism, that it was the chickens coming home to roost. So far as I can tell, very few committed leftists ever stop to think that maybe a terrorist act cannot really be justified in this way. At some point, the terrorist attacks became uncool for the left, and that point was when ISIS and Al-Qaeda began fighting against Bashar al-Assad. The self-same people who would have cheered the resistance of Al-Qaeda to the U.S. occupation in Iraq went on to insist that terrorists in Syria did not deserve the protection of Europe and the U.S. quote-unquote terrorists. And they would embrace this war on terror rhetoric to paint with a broad stroke all of the opposition movements in Syria. The result today is that there is no resistance to the narrative of the war on terror. Yasin El-Haj Saleh comments, "The priorities of the powerful are the powerful priorities. When the U.S. decides the war on terror is a priority, it becomes an international priority. With this has come a significant transformation, namely the securitization of politics, whereby politics becomes focused on security operations and confronting terrorist groups or their sleeper cells. What we have here is not a war fought between conventional armies and international coalitions, nor potentially severe political conflicts, but rather the granting of carte blanche to intelligence agencies to treat immigrants and the citizens of other states, particularly those of the Middle East, in a manner that turns them into rightless and homeless homo sakers, to borrow Giorgio Agamben's concept. The Arab Middle East was avant-garde in this sense of securitizing politics. It is, after all, a paradise for genocidaires, the deprivation of rights, and immunity for crimes. It represents the future of the world in the age of the war on terror. Today, the world's political prisoners are Islamists, where yesterday they had been communists. Moreover, mass extermination and fascism are not accidental developments happening far away, over there in the Middle East. They are a structural product of an international system that has made the war on terror its grand narrative, and made state violence the antidote. In other words, there is much political evil in the Western and international diagnosis of terrorism as the core political evil. The Obama administration treated Daesh as a greater evil, and worked to recruit Syrians to fight it on condition that they didn't fight the regime responsible for 90% of the Syrian death toll. An example illustrating how true it is that terrorism is always the evil and the state always the antidote, even when the latter is privatized and genocidal. In effect, the administration denied Syrians moral and political agency, their right to decide their own enemy and their country's greater evil. This is fundamentally anti-democratic. Indeed, it is a perpetuation of Assad's unrestrained criminality by other means." Unquote. The left in the U.S. and Europe has won the argument against empire, at least temporarily, by covering over the crimes of Russia and Syria. And now the reigning global order is one where state actors can target civilians with impunity. And this is very bad news for people who don't have a state power to protect them, like refugees. It is somehow acceptable in the U.S. left to take an attitude of sympathy towards refugees, but at the same time show absolutely no care whatsoever for the circumstances that created those refugees. For instance, almost no one who advocates for Syrian refugees on the U.S. left decries the crimes of the Assad regime or calls for action against it. As Rohini Hensman notes, regarding the wave of global sympathy that followed the publishing of the image of Aylan Kurdi, a 3-year-old Syrian refugee whose body washed ashore near a Turkish resort. Quote, since the picture of Aylan hit headlines across the world, 6 children have been killed in Syria every day, the majority from barrel bombs and missiles from Syrian government aircraft. But their bloodied and blown apart corpses don't make the front page of any newspaper. None of the other 10,000 children killed in the fighting have. What broke my heart this week was a cartoon by Nida Kadri, a Syrian artist, that pictured Aylan in heaven being welcomed by children. Quote, you are so lucky, Aylan. We are victims of the same war, but no one cared about our death. Unquote. The only viable solution to the refugee crisis would be to end the violence that has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. That is, however, easier said than done. Ending the Syrian crisis would entail, first and foremost, identifying its causes. For some of those who call themselves anti-imperialists, there is only one cause, Western, that is, North American and Western European imperialism, which is responsible for all the bloodshed. The overall message communicated by the omissions, distortions, and outright lies in such accounts is that, firstly, there is no democratic opposition to Assad, and secondly, that it is the West, due to its support for extremist Islamists, that is responsible for most of the current bloodshed in Iraq and Syria, rather than the Assad regime, Hezbollah, the Iraqi Shia militias, and the Iranian and Russian forces. These writers cover up the real causes of the massive exodus, enabling the war crimes and crimes against humanity to continue, leading to more deaths, continuing Islamist radicalization, and the continuing outflow of refugees. Unquote. Moreover, this wave of Syrian refugees that occurred after Russia began its own bombing campaigns in Syria in 2015 was part of a broader Russian campaign to undermine the stability of European nations. It was combined with Russian support for far-right parties in Germany, for instance, and an intensive propaganda campaign villainizing refugees. Timothy Snyder comments, quote, facing rising numbers of refugees from war in Syria, as well as migrants fleeing Africa, Merkel took an unexpected position. Germany would accept large numbers of refugees, more than its neighbors, more than her voters would have wished. On September 8, 2015, the German government announced that it planned to take 500,000 refugees per year. By no coincidence, Russia began bombing Syria 3 weeks later. Speaking at the United Nations on September 28, 2015, Putin proposed a harmonization of Eurasia with the European Union. Russia would bomb Syria to generate refugees, then encourage Europeans to panic. This would help the Alternative für Deutschland, the German Nazi Party, and thus make Europe more like Russia. Russia bombs began to fall in Syria the day after Putin spoke. Russian aircraft dropped non-precision, dumb bombs from high altitudes. Even if the targets had been military, non-precision bombing would have guaranteed more destruction and more refugees making their way to Europe. But Russia was not generally targeting ISIS bases. Human rights organizations reported the Russian bombing of mosques, clinics, hospitals, refugee camps, water treatment plants, and cities in general. In her decision to accept Syrian refugees, Merkel was motivated by the history of the 1930s, when Nazi Germany made its own Jewish citizens into refugees. The Russian response was in effect to say, if Merkel wants refugees, we will provide them, and use the issue to destroy her government and German democracy. Russia supplied not just the refugees themselves, but also the image of them as terrorists and rapists. On Monday, January 11, 2016, a 13-year-old German girl of Russian origin, Lisa F., hesitated to return to her home in Berlin. She had once again had problems in school, and the way her family treated her had aroused the attention of authorities. She went to the house of a 19-year-old boy, visited with him and his mother, and stayed the night. Lisa F.'s parents reported her missing to the police. She returned home the next day without her backpack and cell phone. She told her mother a dramatic story of abduction and rape. The police, following up the report of the missing girl, went to the residence of the friend and found her things. By speaking to her friend and his mother, finding the backpack, and reading text messages, they established where Lisa F. had been. When questioned, Lisa F. told the police what had happened. She had not wanted to go home and had gone elsewhere. A medical examination confirmed that the story she had told her mother was untrue. A Berlin family drama then played as global news on Russian television. On January 16, 2016, a Saturday, Pervia Canal presented a version of what Lisa F. had told her parents. She had been abducted by Muslim refugees and gang-raped for an entire night. This was the first of no fewer than 40 segments on Pervia Canal about an event that, according to a police investigation, had never taken place. On the televised coverage, photographs were pasted from other places and times to add an element of verisimilitude to the story. The Russian propaganda network Sputnik chimed in with the general speculation that refugee rapists were loose in Germany. On January 17th, the extreme right National Democratic Party organized a demonstration demanding justice for Lisa F. Although only about a dozen people appeared, one of them was an RT cameraman. His footage appeared on YouTube the same day. The information war against Merkel was taken up openly by the Russian state. The Russian embassy in London tweeted that Germany rolled out the red carpet for refugees and then swept their crimes under the carpet, unquote. The Russian ambitions to extend its empire in the Ukraine, as we discuss in the podcast regarding the Ukraine, led Vladimir Putin to attack Hillary Clinton in her 2016 presidential campaign and help Donald Trump get elected. I think it's past time for a robust discussion of how the left came to this historic defeat, not just in terms of being unable to keep a fascist out of the White House, but having helped to put him there. In the next podcast, I'll return to the history of the U.S. left in the 20th century to tie all the threads together from the very beginning of this podcast to explain this basic problem revealed by the failure of the left on Syria, that the far left has become a tool for Russian fascism.
Next time on A Democratic Socialist Almanac.
On the Maidan, a Ukrainian civil society of incredible self-organization and solidarity is thriving. On the one hand, this society is internally differentiated by ideology, language, culture, religion, and class. But on the other, it is united by certain elementary sentiments. We do not need your permission. We are not going to ask you for something. We are not afraid of you. We will do everything ourselves. Unquote from Snyder. So if you recall, Marx defined the dictatorship of the proletariat as the domination of the state by civil society, leading to the dissolution of class differences. The uplifting of all members of civil society in a radically democratic coalition. We have seldom caught glimpses of that possibility, the possibility of people directly and democratically organizing their own lives. But in the Maidan, we got a clear vision of it, on the same level as the Paris Commune. On the 20th of February, 2014, snipers massacred hundreds of protesters on the Maidan. A few days later, Russia prepared its own population for war with the Ukraine by broadcasting false reports of Ukrainian atrocities in the Crimea. They made up a story about Ukrainians crucifying a Russian boy. They shelled Ukrainian civilian areas and broadcast news stories about how the Ukraine was shelling its own towns. Russian forces invaded without Russian insignia, then pretended to be local separatist guerrillas. Russians were bussed in to pretend to be protesters storming county government buildings in order to stage the popular overthrow of local government. And then they shot down Malaysian flight MH17.
A Democratic Socialist Almanac is a podcast exploring all things relevant to socialism today, from the latest scholarship regarding the socialist tradition to socialist reflections on our current moment and where to go from there. Follow us on Facebook, subscribe where you get your podcasts, and support us on Patreon.